Good afternoon. My talk is called First to the Party, and I am pleased to announce that UPenn Press will be publishing a book by that title next summer. And it's going to be hard getting across the gist of that book in 15 minutes, but I'll do my best. I'm going to talk about the transformation of the Democratic Party on civil rights. Now, while that is an interesting story in its own right, it's also a very important story for understanding the nature of political parties. Just about everybody agrees that parties are important, but why are they important? A common argument in my field, which is political science, is that parties formulate policies in order to win elections for party politicians, thereby giving voice and agency to what majorities want. An alternative view, which I'm going to articulate today, is that parties are the vehicles by which organized groups and activists get what they want out of American politics. And representing organized groups is not the same as representing voters. For example, if African Americans needed to wait until popular majorities were on their side, they would have had to wait longer for civil rights. I look specifically at party transformation because by looking at who is in charge at times when parties change, we get an idea of, kind of who is the driving force behind parties. So a classic view of party change in general and the party's change on race in particular is Carmine's and Stimson's 1889 book called Issue Evolution. They attribute party change generally to the decisions of party leaders. A politician is entrepreneurial. He sees that by changing on an issue, he can get new votes. And once he wins using that platform, other politicians in the party follow suit. So Lyndon Johnson comes out in favor of civil rights. He wins elections. Other Democrats follow suits. That is the classic model. My contribution is that groups, rather than candidates, transform political parties. And furthermore, the groups often do this on the basis of strategic decisions rather than just ideology. So sometimes two or more groups will tie together a party agenda on the basis of complementary strategic advantages more than anything else. So in particular, I look at the Congress of Industrial Organizations, or the CIO, and the NAACP, which is probably the most prestigious and effective voice for civil rights in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. So Goldwater said to go hunting where the ducks are. But that's only part of the story. Sometimes organized groups point to where politicians should go hunting. They point out particular hunting grounds as better than others. And sometimes they will groom hunting grounds to be desirable. And they can also establish exclusive policies where you're not allowed to go into that hunting grounds if you're going to come to my hunting grounds. In this case, what I'm referring to is the CIO and the NAACP would tell Democratic politicians that you can't get our votes and our support and simultaneously get the support of white Southerners. I do this using archival research, which makes me very unusual in my field of political science. The usual method is to look at surveys and congressional voting records, but I think that if you want to see if groups matter, it's really hard to determine from that, because groups don't like to advertise the kind of influence they have over parties. It's in the back. But if you can look at archival records, which were private 30, 40, 50 years ago, they're often candid, because nobody expected them to become public for a long time. And you can see who is influencing whom by looking at the communications between group leaders and party leaders. So let's start by looking at the NAACP and how it wound up making an alliance with the CIO. The NAACP started out pretty narrowly focused on civil rights, anti-lynching laws, poll taxes, and eventually desegregation. It's only over time that it became to support a wide variety of liberal policies, including labor rights. So in fact, during the 1930s, they were opposed to labor rights at many junctures because labor unions had a history of excluding blacks. It's why so many blacks served as strike breakers. And so the NAACP, along with the Urban League, testified against the National Recovery Act, which empowered labor unions in Section 7A. This, they thought, would deprive blacks of jobs and blacks as opportunity as strike breakers. The first president of the NAACP, Moorfield Story, even thought that you should be able to sue labor unions for preventing people who weren't part of the union from getting jobs. Part of this also depended on who was in charge. In the 1930s, Executive Secretary Walter White specialized in legal strategies, and so he wanted to keep the organization focused on desegregation, poll taxes, anti-lynching laws. He thought that a working-class strategy, such as that favored by W.E.B. Du Bois, would sink his star in the organization, and he managed to maneuver so that W.E.B. Du Bois was forced to resign. Things changed around 1940. And what's happening then is the NAACP is really suffering for membership and money. The IRS starts classifying it as a political organization, meaning that donations can no longer be tax exempt. This really hurt them. Furthermore, the Depression really hurt them, where a lot of black middle class people could no longer afford to donate. And finally, as the Wagner Act empowers labor unions, unions become a powerhouse. They appear to be the way of the future, and the NAACP is afraid of antagonizing a potential employer for African Americans, as it seemed to be going the way of the future, and resisting it seemed to be inevitable. So what do? For one thing, they cease suing discriminatory labor unions. They had some success in this in the late 30s and early 40s. They back away from that in the early 40s to avoid antagonizing them. There are proposals in Congress for an amendment to the Wagner Act to exclude discriminatory unions. Now, in order to earn favor with labor unions, they proposed their own substitute amendment. And this prevented champions of civil rights in Congress from saying, hey, this amendment is necessary to fight for civil rights. They symbolically hired a white-only union to print their magazine, The Crisis. They even intervene in the Ford strike. Now, the auto workers in particular were very generous to African Americans, and so they were among the most reluctant in the country to join unions. At a strike at the Ford plant in 1941, thousands of blacks were trapped inside the plant during the strike. The NAACP went around with a sound car, urging them to cooperate with the unions. Now, in private, Executive Secretary Walter White was wide open to the risks of what a union economy could mean. He said that the Negro had the grim choice of casting its lot with the discriminatory union or earning its hostility forever afterwards. They changed their focus to include social welfare. So in the 40s, you see the NAACP favoring federal assistance to housing, education, healthcare, and some other things. They even oppose anti-discrimination amendments to all of these bills, knowing that if they're passed, they're going to cause the bill as a whole to fail, and this will make their liberal allies upset with them, the CIO in particular. They oppose right-to-work laws. And together with unions, they prioritized the Fair Employment Practices Commission, which started as an anti-wartime discrimination measure, but they wanted to broaden it to the whole economy. And this was an ideal instrument for driving a wedge between civil rights and Republicans. It was only recently, remember, that blacks had considered voting Democrat. This usurped what employers viewed was their hiring prerogative. Nobody had ever questioned it before. And it was modeled after the hated National Labor Relations Board. And so by prioritizing this, this made it very hard for Republicans to reach out to civil rights groups when voters interested in civil rights are being told that the Fair Employment Practices Commission is the most important part of the civil rights agenda behind us. In the end, Brown was really the signature achievement of the NAACP, and Brown, they needed about $100,000 in funding the year before Brown. They were heavily in debt. They got about $75,000 of that from union sources, CIO sources in particular. Now, why did the CIO go along with it? They, too, had strategic advantages in working together with the NAACP. Both of them had a common interest in repealing poll taxes, because poll tax excluded both blacks and working class whites from voting. Back then, civil rights referred very much more broadly to the freedom of association. And the civil rights laws could protect not only blacks, but unions from gathering and associating. And so both of them had a common interest in federal civil rights laws. But perhaps above all, the CIO wanted the Democratic Party to be their vehicle in politics. And who was standing in their way? The Southern Democrats, who were opposed not only to civil rights, but to labor rights. So they had a very common enemy with the NAACP and blacks in general. Now, what I'm going to show you now is that the even though they had sort of tried to braid union rights and civil rights, the Democrats didn't go along with that. In the 1944 election, they almost nominated a segregationist Southerner, James Burns, as Roosevelt's vice president, even though he was visibly sick and people knew there was a good chance that this would be the next president. It was the CIO that vetoed the choice of James Burns, and they came up with the compromise candidate of Harry Truman. Harry Truman, at first, looks like he's going to support civil rights in 1948, but he backs down almost immediately. In January, he talks about civil rights, and by February, he denies he ever supported desegregating the armed forces, for example, or the federal government, because there was a Southerner governor's meetings and other meetings of Southern Democrats, there was talking about bolting. But the ADA, Americans for Democratic Action, and the CIO was not going to let him back down. At the convention, they insisted against his wishes on a very bold civil rights platform. Truman and his advisors and the Democratic leaders of Congress lobbied against the ADA-CIO plank late into the night. It is the delegates who are very carefully chosen by the ADA who pass this against the president's wishes. In Truman's diary, he called them crackpots. He says the crackpots hope the South will bolt. Once this was forced on him, the South walks out, and he has no choice but to give African Americans what they want. And so when they threaten a march on Washington, you know, he can't afford to alienate both them and the South, so he signs an executive order desegregating the armed forces. Now, I'm running short on time, but I argue in the book that really subsequent platforms and nominees don't back away from it. Adlai Stevenson's moderation on race has been exaggerated. Fast forwarding to 1960, you had two candidates that had in the past assiduously courted the South, Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy. People don't remember this, but John F. Kennedy had voted for the amendment to the 57 Civil Rights Act, which would have referred violations to white juries, and so had Lyndon Johnson. But really, by threatening Kennedy in his re-election in Massachusetts campaign in 1958, does he start to back away from the support he sought from the South. There was a liberal challenge at the convention in 1960, supported by Eleanor Roosevelt and others, by Adlai Stevenson. In order to deflect this, he supports a very bold platform in 1960. It was only to deflect this liberal challenge because the Kennedys at the time had a reputation for moderation. So this period as a whole, I think, argues strong evidence against the ideas of responsive parties. At first, Truman thinks he wins with black voters, but then the South threatens to bolt, so he thinks he needs to get them back. It's really only the organized groups that force the party to change on this issue, and subsequent nominees don't dare back away from that. Now, so the issue of civil rights became a uniting cause of the Liberal Labor Alliance, where because of the past tensions between blacks and labor unions, it might have instead been a dividing issue. It's the organized groups that, by repairing relations and sort of threatening nominees, that get this into the Democratic Party. What does that tell for the future? It suggests that Donald Trump will not be carrying his torch forward into the Republican Party. He differs from the party on a number of issues, among them protectionism and sort of on economic moderation or even liberalism, depending on which statements you're looking at by him. But basically, party transformations of the past, of which I've given you one example, and in each party transformation in the past, you had to have organized activists who fight not just in one nomination and not just for one candidate, but in many conventions and fight to maintain change over time. And so far, I don't really see Trump as really inspiring sort of mid-level party activists in the party. His whole method of getting nominated was to bypass the activists in the party and reach out to rank and file voters using mass media. And that's never been the basis of a party transformation on the time. And so groups are the life of the party and their most important moving parts. They initiate party change when old groups are resistant to change and politicians at most want to straddle. So in that sense, they are first to the party.